Late Night City. Scousers Abroad.
Let's go live to New Zealand. Hello, John.
Kia ora, Peter. How are you?
I'm well. We were panicking a bit.
Yeah, I believe so. There was a trouble with the making the connection.
Yeah, but not to worry. Can you believe that it is as clear as this? And you're in New Zealand and I'm in England.
I know. I'm sat here out on the deck. It's the third day of brilliant blue skies and sunshine. What can I tell you?
I just find it amazing. I think the world is such a different world we live in now that we can have a connection this good. Tell us where you are in New Zealand.
Well, we live in Auckland, in West Auckland, in a place called Te Tairangi,
right.
Which is just surrounded by native bush and coastline and stuff. It's just, yeah, it's to die for, really.
Now, is it Auckland where you had the earthquake?
No, we're volcanoes, Peter.
Sorry, volcano.
Yeah, we're volcanoes. Right. The earthquake was a bit further south, although the last one to strike here, we were up north staying with friends, and we actually got a tsunami warning in the middle of the night.
Wow.
So you kind of start getting used to, you know, natural disasters and planning for them.
Where are you originally from?
Originally from Liverpool, lived in Anfield, and then went Daneville Road. And then the family moved across to Runcorn, to the new town, when they were being developed.
Yeah.
And I stayed there until late 70s, early 80s, and then went to work and live in Sheffield. So I used to commute back from Sheffield until coming to New Zealand in 2002.
You certainly haven't lost your accent.
Well, it depends, really. Sometimes there's a bit of a Yorkshire twang from all the years in Sheffield.
Right.
Usually if I'm watching the Blues, the accent comes back. Or if I'm having an argument or tired, the accent comes back.
You know. Now, why New Zealand? All the places in the world, why New Zealand?
Well, long story short, was a friend of ours came to New Zealand when John, that's my partner, John Butler and I were living in Sheffield, and a friend was coming to New Zealand, and she knew we wanted to move. And so she said, look, if you're interested in my house, I'm going to put it on the market. So we bought a vet's house, and then 5 years later, she turned up at the doorstep out of the blue one Easter and said, I've come to tell you you should come to New Zealand. And she showed us some pictures.
Mm-hmm.
We came out on holiday that year and made application. And it was one of those things, instead of saying no, it's, you know, too late, because I was in my mid-40s then. We decided to say yes, and we kind of like went for it, not knowing the size of the challenge we were taking on, really.
So 40 years old you decided to go?
I was in my mid-40s when we came out, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because that's a hell of a time to change your life.
Well, it is, but it was one of those things, honestly, it was just one of those things where normally you'd say no for good reason. We just thought about it and thought, well, why don't we give it a go? What's the worst that can happen is we pack up and come back again. And we just, we kept the house on in Sheffield for a while and arrived in New Zealand. In those days, I was the main applicant and I was given 6 months to find a job. But we didn't know that when you came in November, it's the middle of, you know, Christmas and summer holidays hit the other side of the year to us.
Mm.
So everywhere was closed. And at one stage, we thought we were going to have to go back.
Oh, yeah.
But I ended up getting a lecturer's job at a Māori-based polytechnic and just loved it. And that just set us up, really. From there, we just got established here.
Did he get homesick at all?
There's certain things catch you out. People, certainly you miss people.
Mm.
Like my cousin who got me into this call, Denise. You know, you can Skype and stuff like you were saying earlier.
Yeah.
It's a different world.
Yeah.
You miss people. You miss certain things, like, you know, picking up the match half a day late and those kind of things. I tell you what's strange. We've just had John's sister, Phyllis, my sister-in-law, and a really good friend of ours, Caroline, over. And immediately they walk in the house, your rear-view mirror goes back 30, 40, 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when you emigrate, no one tells you that your rear-view mirror starts the day you arrive. So things being familiar, you kind of miss. But I've only been back to the UK twice since 2002. And yeah, it's strange. Like I say, it's strange the things you miss. You know, newspapers, mushy peas, those kind of little things you come across and you think, oh, yeah, I remember that. Oh, I missed that.
Is it strange having two Johns in the family?
It never has been. I mean, we've been together.
So people don't say John, and you both go, yeah.
Yeah, oh, that's happened.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
It's been interesting when we, growing up, you know, like friends' kids, we were guardians to a couple of them, and they've known John and John all their life. And it's never been kind of like an issue for them. Mm-hmm. They just call one. I get called John Hanny, and John got called John Butty, so it was Hanny and Butty.
Yeah.
And it just got sorted, really.
How long have the two Johns been together?
I'm going to get this wrong about you. It's 28 years, coming up 29 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, a long time.
That's a nice relationship, that 29 years. How did you meet?
He could have murdered me and been out by now.
How did you meet? how did you meet? Where did you meet?
Well, we were both in social work in Sheffield at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we met through a friend in common. And at the time, I had a cross Labrador called Dylan and needed someone to look after him when I was away for the weekend. And we kind of met that way and through this friend and through dog sitting. And, we just went out for a drink one night. And when John said, oh, that was really nice, I'd like to do that again, the penny dropped that it was kind of like he was trying to tell me he was interested. So,
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. From the next day, we've just been together ever since.
And to use an old-fashioned expression, have you tied the knot?
We did. Well, we got as far as a civil ceremony here in New Zealand. So whether we go the next stage and make that a marriage is something it's whether we want to party again, really, at the end of the day.
Now, what is gay life like in New Zealand?
It's kind of varied. Auckland's by far the biggest city. I mean, there's 1.5 million out of a population of 4.5 million that live in Auckland. So this is the big place. This is the big population. So there's clubs and there's pubs, there's societies, you name it, happening in Auckland.
Are gay people accepted?
Again, you know, it's a very religious country. It's a very Christian country, and you get some people who still have a thing about if you're gay, it's going against the word of God.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got other people who are very committed Christians who will say, "Get over yourselves." You know, if it's a loving relationship, it's a loving relationship. So all that mix is still happening here. And the further you go south, out of the main cities, really. You can still sometimes get, you know, a reaction or people not sure because it's not an everyday occurrence. But in the time we've been here, it's been more of a problem finding a place to stay where we can take our dogs than it has us being a gay couple.
That's ridiculous. So when you first got off when you first got off the plane, were people wary of you because you're a couple or not? Or was it acceptance straight away?
Well, no, because we came into Auckland. And so I think had we gone to, you know, the back of beyond, it may have felt different or been a different experience. But, I mean, I kind of lecture in social work and I do a lot of work around diversity and difference and you can see it in each generation of students. There's just kind of like more and more of an acceptance of difference, really, that's kind of like happening. I would say it's a safe enough place to be. The worst experience we had was one place we lived in Sheffield, believe it or not. And
I believe it.
You know. Yeah,
I believe it. So, John, it's a special day there today, isn't it?
It is, yeah, but you're talking to John Hancock, not John Butler. You got the Johns mixed up.
Right, it's the John Butler I've got here written down, so it's Hancock.
Oh, it's because of the email. No, it's John Hancock. So you're the one. Right. You're the Butler. You're the John's John Butler.
Right, well, I've been saying John Butler all night, so...
But it's probably me just hearing it for the first time, mate.
Sorry about that.
No, but you're right. Today's a really special day. 6th of February is they call them public holidays over here, not bank holidays, but it's the Treaty of Waitangi Day. So this is the day that the Crown, the British Crown, signed an agreement with Maori in 1840 up in the north of the island in Waitangi. And that set the agreement for New Zealand to come under the partnership. It was a partnership with the Crown. What's happened after that was like there was about 120, 140 years of colonialization that then got debated, and in the last 30-40 years there's been new settlements with the Crown. It's really big over here, so it's the national day. It's what brought the country, all the tribes together, the British together, and formed the partnership. So and then the two languages, Te Reo and British, and yeah, so it's really significant day today.
Do you have any friends who are Maoris?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I working at the Wānanga, like I say, when I first came over, I literally stepped off the plane and walked into Maori culture, and you know, people were just so gracious and so giving and supportive. And where I work now, out at Manukau Institute, which is the south of the city. It's the biggest Polynesian population in the world and big Maori population. So you're kind of brought into the culture and the different cultures. And that's just been an awesome experience and opportunity to experience that, really.
John, what's their culture like? How different is it to New Zealand people?
It is very different in the sense that each tribe, each iwi, is very much based on the collective. So you've got the marae, which is the meeting house, and that the people of that area are called tangata whenua, the people of the land. And you're not part of that group until you're brought through the meeting house. Mm-hmm. So things are done collectively. Extended families, really important, and knowing your roots and your generations. They call the whakapapa. That's really big over here. So much so that it's got me into looking at my family tree again. But then it's also, you know, it's the customs and traditions and the language have been, you know, fought hard to maintain alongside the British coming here. And now both are, you know, there's a lot of hard work going on for both cultures to be accepted and treated with respect and equally, really.
John, do you think they have as many problems as the Australian indigenous people?
I think because of the treaty, that's made a difference. The treaty was nearly forgotten about. But no, I think I just got to Australia a couple of times this year for the first time, I'm ashamed to say. And I think the treatment of the Aboriginal people was a lot harsher, lot worse than happened with Maori. Although the language here, Te Reo, nearly died out. It's very similar to Wales in a sense, the Welsh language, and it was brought back through schools, through passing acts of parliament, through... So you drive around now and you're as likely to see names in Te Reo alongside British names side by side. I think the treaty made a big difference, I would say. I don't know fully the Aboriginal experience, but it was certainly, from my visits this year, a lot harsher, certainly at the beginning, you know, when the British first arrived. Yeah.
In New Zealand, do they have their own, have they kept their own lands, or is all of New Zealand theirs? How does it work?
Well, of course, when the British first arrived, everything was owned by Maori, and there was no British land as such. And the Maori tradition is that you never own land. it doesn't belong to you, right. but that you're guardians of it, you're custodians of it. So, what you know, you read the history books, and people were coming off the ships and buying land, and then when they moved, Maori expected to get that back because you didn't need it anymore.
Right.
And suddenly the British had introduced, you know, deeds and land settlements and British law, and so Maori increasingly lost the land, and that's part of what's happening now with treaty settlements. So areas like national parks are being handed back to the original Maori, and Maori and the Crown are now running them in partnership, and a recognition that it should never have been taken away in the first place, but was, because a whole new, you know, it's like someone plunking a new government, a new system on your doorstep and saying, well, this is now how you're going to be ruled. And that's only since 1840, so it's still a relatively young country in terms of the relationship between new immigrants and, of which I'm one, and Tangata Whenua, the native Maori.
Now, I believe you want some help on something.
Hello?
I believe you want some help on something, John.
I do, yeah, if that's possible.
Yeah, of course.
One of the things I'm doing here is, at 60, would you believe, I turned 60 last year, but I'm finally getting around to finishing my master's study, and I grew up an Evertonian through family connections, and what I'm looking to do, you know, growing up also and coming to terms with being gay, I'm interested in why we as gay men are attracted to football, follow football, when at the minute there's no out professional gay player and hasn't been. But what I wanted to do, Pete, is tell our story as kind of like gay men. So I'm looking to get 5-6 guys who are happy to talk about their experiences coming to terms with being gay, who have got a passion with football or support football or even play football, so they can tell that side of the story. And then the second half of the interview is asking them their views and their opinions, given that the football authorities... Let's Tackle Homophobia doesn't get the same status as Let's Tackle Racism. So by getting all these stories together, I can put the I can add to the gay voice within football and within soccer. So if there's, and when I started, I was going to focus on Everton. I was going to look to make it purely my club, and without boring everybody, I've needed to broaden it out, and that's partly being 12,000 miles away, because what I need is somebody who is either on Skype or is prepared to Skype with me, so I can record the interviews. I've got a couple of people I still need to complete the study, and I've no Evertonians. I've got a Liverpool supporter, West Ham, Sheffield United, Sunderland, and it might be that the research completes without a blue boy, so I'm looking to see if there's anybody on Merseyside who is a gay man into football, would be open to me interviewing them a couple of times, then I'd love to add them to the research. And they can email me.
Yeah, I was going to say, the way would be email.
Yeah. And if they want to email me, I'll treat that obviously in confidence. Mm-hmm. And I can send the stuff about the research out. I'm looking to get all this written up and completed by June. So I'm needing to move quickly, but the email would be butler, which is BUTLER, dot Hancocks, HANCOX, at extra, which is XTRA, .co.nz. And anybody, or I guess you guys have got my information there as well.
We have so indeed, but let's have that again really slowly.
Okay, so it's butler, BUTLER, dot Hancocks, HANCOX, at extra, which is xtra.co.nz. And the research has been done through Otago University, which is down in the south of the island. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's one of the things, you know, when you say what you miss, one of the things here in New Zealand is being really good is meeting up with both New Zealanders from, you know, Māori, Pacifica, Kiwi, and expats, and just having football in common. And it's interesting what you pick up. My boss, who I used to, a woman who is my boss, Deborah, who left last year where I work, she's a big Burnley fan. And used to have a season ticket at Turf Moor. So now I find myself looking for Burnley's results because we used to natter about the football, and people at work used to think that when Everton played Burnley, it was some big match because we would have a go at each other prior to the game and after the game. So everything that happens at home still happens over here, and it's just a nice connection. What I want to do is tell the story of gay men within that and get the gay voice within that to add to the wider debate as to why it's still, you know, you can be lots of things and a professional player, but somehow you still can't say you're a gay man and a professional player.
Interesting, John. We'll have a little talk about this now ourselves. I am, as you know, an openly gay man. I have incredible views on everything, and I believe that everybody should be treated as an equal, and we shouldn't have to hide our sexuality. But I quite openly say in my Echo column, and I quite openly say on this radio show, if there are any gay footballers, do not come out the closet. Stay exactly where you are. I wouldn't wish the torment and torture they would get on my worst enemy.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's always a possibility, Pete.
I don't think it's a possibility. I think it's more than a possibility, John. You go to the crowd and you hear the way they get taunted at the best of times, you know, and it is horrendous. And yet, in rugby, rugby players can come out, which several have, and they're treated totally and utterly differently.
Absolutely. And, I mean, Nigel Owens, the Welsh Rugby Union referee, I mean, he's classed as the world authority in refereeing, and he was here, you know, All Blacks Australia, you don't get more macho and testosterone than that, and people were really pleased that he was reffing because he's such a good referee. I think one of the things with the, without preempting the research I'm doing, but talking to the guys that I am talking to, is, you know, there is a feeling that, you know, it's round the corner. There's also a feeling that it needs to maybe happen in a collective, you know, that you get five or six, because if you look at the grassroots research and the reports coming through, the mood has changed on the terraces over the years. So, like, you know, the Rainbow Lace movement that I know Everton took part in, other clubs have. Amongst the fans, the shift is happening where they're saying we don't want this stigma to still be part of the game. And that's why I didn't want to go at, well, why hasn't it happened for professional players? Important though that question is, I wanted to add to the voice of guys who have been going maybe for a lifetime or growing up gay and attract, you know, find football the same passion as everybody else. So it's telling stories that have commonality, because I think then, although there will be the backlash, you know, it's, and I don't take that lightly, I think collectively it will happen. And you know, 10 years from now, when I'm nice and retired and sitting in the sunshine still, people will be saying, well, what was the fuss about?
God, I wish I had your optimism. I really do over this. I really, really do. When I hear certain players and they're slagging off their children, slagging off their wives, and I think, oh my word, what the hell is going on? That's what upsets me. That's what upsets me.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember, Pete, going to an FA Cup tie where there was a group of Everton supporters who were chanting, Everton are white. And that wasn't that long ago. It was only a couple of decades ago. And so, you know, the FA was saying, oh, we've tackled racism in football. And I'm thinking, because Alan pulled me back because I was going to go and have a word, and he said, don't be stupid. Now, a few years later, you know, 1995, we win the FA Cup, and there's a black captain holding up the trophy. So changes do happen. And I think what's interesting is, you know, 10% of the population at any one time are gay men, are lesbian women. The gay community's never outed anybody, and I'm not saying they should. It's one of the questions I talk about. But everybody knows the players are out there. The law of averages says you can't.
Oh, no,
they're
out there. They're out there without any shadow of a doubt. And there are people in a lot of sports worlds, like karate, which is a man's, you know, there's so many people out there in different worlds. That's, and I'm with you, but I just wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy.
Yeah.
I really, it's the one thing. Anything else, I haven't got a problem with. This is the one thing I've got a problem with. And I was castigated when I wrote about it in my column. I've just recently written a piece in my column a couple of weeks ago, and a couple of the gay papers agreed with me, but a couple of the gay papers disagreed vehemently about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the sad thing is it's going to need to be a player or players who are at the top of their game. Although, having said that, I was reading a lad who plays in non-league or semi-professional league, Al Cleethorpe's way, and he's come out while he's playing. And he was saying there's been one instance of a player making homophobic comments to him. It hasn't had the impact. Now, you might say, well, he's under the radar. It's kind of like happening in lots of places. You know, people are knocking on the door. People are, you know, like I say. And
yeah, but it needs a big player. It needs a big player to come out.
Yeah.
That's the only way it will work.
Yeah, or a group of them, I think, Pete. You know, a group of players. So, you know, could you imagine if every club in the Premiership said, well, here's our player. Mm. Or our player wants to say this is who he is. Then, you know, it's kind of, well, okay, so what's the deal now? Because you're not, you know, the people who will slag off their own players, you know, once it becomes you can't keep doing that or that's no longer acceptable. It's like when black players broke into the football world, you know, the racism and the abuse and the chants.
But racism is still going on.
Of course it is, but it's like it's not condoned and it's not okay, is what I'm saying.
No, it's not condoned, okay, but it's still going on.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is that undercurrent of, you know, it will always be the case. But if the solution is stay in the closet, then what's the cost, you know? So these are the things that I'm hoping the research will add to the debate about. I'm not saying I've got right or wrong. I'm wanting for my research to add to this to the bigger debate.
And once again, if they're out there, how will they email to you?
They can email me direct on butler.hancox@extra.co.nz.
Right, let's have some name checks. Say hello to a few people who'll be listening, in particular Denise.
I've got to mention Denise, otherwise I'll never be able to go back home again. Denise and her husband Dick, who's a Southampton fan, who will be beside himself with the semi-final results. And Denise's brother Alan, my other cousin. I've still got sisters, a couple of sisters down in Runcorn there. So there's Anne and there's Eileen and Kia, Eileen's husband. And then my nieces, there's Lisa, Melissa and Helen, and lovely Zach, who's Helen's lad. I'm frightened now. I'm going to miss somebody, but you know, there's all the family, all the whānau, as we say over here in the UK. And I know there's a cousin this year. I've reconnected with a cousin who's over in Philadelphia, who's another blue boy who came out to New Zealand, and we reconnected. So Dave and Judy over there, and there's a cousin down in Melbourne, Marie. And her husband, Malcolm, who we got over to see. So, like you were saying at the beginning, it's the world's a smaller place when you make all these connections.
But, and, by the way, hasn't your team or isn't your team doing well?
We've suddenly, now we've knocked ourselves out of two cup competitions that I thought we had a chance in. He's suddenly turning it round. And, I mean, six goals you can't complain about, even if you're letting three in. I think we're coming good, and I think this is a manager who wants to build something. So I think I think it's going to be an interesting couple of years going forward.
John, you're in.
Sophie again.
A really interesting man, and I cannot believe the quality of this line. I really can't believe. I don't believe you're in New Zealand. I believe you're. I'm looking across the water. I reckon you're in Birkenhead.
Well, let me just tell you before we have to go. There is actually a Birkenhead over the water from Auckland.
It is one of
the greenest, lushest, most expensive areas to live. And I keep saying to people, oh, this is like the Birkenhead back home. It looks exactly the same.
John, it's been a delight talking to you. You take care.
I will do. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Na ora, mate. You take care, mate.